50. And now the interesting question, and I've had this discussion with Joel Hallis, W1ZR, the guy who writes this beautiful article called The Doctor Is In every month in QSD Magazine, one of my favorite sections. He and I have had lots of emails back and forth. Let me drop them.
By the way, I just looked up the sludge for 43, and the biggest one you can get is 10 kilowatts.
And I'd like to believe that 10 kilowatts is a peak indicating slug, that 10 kilowatts of CW power would say a type N connector. I know a type N connector for more than a few seconds is not going to survive that. Any reasonable type N connector that's had any real field service, if you know what I mean, field.
The EIA connectors for 43, though. The EIA connectors don't handle that much power.
Are you telling me you can put an EIA connector on the case of a Bird Model 43? Go ahead, Eric.
It looks like the biggest one you can put on it is a half inch. A half inch, I think. The limit is 9.5 or something like that.
This is DPC with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Okay, I had a situation a few years ago where I had to measure the VSWR in a 75 ohm line. And what I did, and I used a 50 ohm bird, it just came back to me, we were talking about it. I made a Z section before and after the bird watt meter to convert the impedance down to 50 ohms, the 75 ohm impedance. That way I was able to use a 50 ohm bird to make an SWR measurement on a 75 ohm line. A section in front of the bird and after the bird dropped it down to 50 each way, and we had accurate measuring method of measuring the power. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, Hal called that a Z section. Among the moon bounce people, they call it a quarter wave matching transformer. If I had a 75 ohm line and I wanted to match to a 50 ohm piece of equipment, if I put in between those two transmission lines a quarter wavelength, including velocity factor, of line that is the geometric mean, in other words, you multiply 75 times 50, take the square root, end up with 61.2. If I used a quarter wavelength of 60.2 ohm transmission line, and I put it in between the 50 ohm system and the 75 ohm system, at that frequency, in theory, they will be perfectly matched. It's called a quarter wave matching transformer. That's one solution. But here's the original problem. Let me drop this. I have a perfect 70 ohm, let's make it 75. I've got a perfect 75 ohm dummy load on the far end of a 75 ohm transmission line. As I pour power down that transmission line, you know there is no standing wave ratio. Of any power that gets into that transmission line, it's a 75 ohm line with a perfect 75 ohm dummy load. The power goes down that line once, all of it goes into that 75 ohm dummy load, gets turned into heat, none of it comes back. Now I take my Bird 43, which is designed for 50 ohms, and I put it onto that 70 ohm line with that dummy load. My Bird watt meter will measure a certain power forward and power reverse ratio, and you go to the curve, it will be a 1.4 standing wave ratio. The Bird will tell you the truth. 1.4 standing wave ratio is true in that measurement. The next question is, where the hell is the 1.4 standing wave ratio coming from? I don't know the exact number, maybe it's a 20 dB reflection coefficient. Where is it coming from? And the answer is, the inside coaxial cable of the Bird Model 43 is a 50 ohm line. At the tip of that 50 ohm line on the right hand side, where it joins your 70 ohm transmission line, which is perfectly terminated, that's where the reflection is taking place. You've made a sudden jump in impedance, and Mother Nature doesn't like any mismatches, any instantaneous mismatches that are not slowly tapered, and so the reflection is occurring inside of your Bird watt meter in that circumstance. You'll be amazed how many people will make that measurement, a 70 ohm transmission line, let me drop. A 70 ohm transmission line with a 70 ohm termination, a 50 ohm Bird watt meter, they'll measure a 1.4 Biswatt, they are positive. There is a 1.4 standing wave ratio on that 75 ohm transmission line. And you can argue that one until the cows come home and they won't see it any other way. There's a lot of misunderstanding on that one. And as I said, me and the people at ARRL had a number of emails back and forth on this exact subject, because that and the related subject, there's a significant number of people who will think that the Bird Model 43, for instance, will only accurately measure forward and reverse power if there is some integral number of wavelengths of cable on the far end of that bird. That it must be measuring into an antenna that has some number of half waves or quarter waves or full waves of cable, and that any other length of cable is not going to read correctly. There's a zillion people who believe that. You study every single chapter of the Bird 43 Owner's Manual. It does not say that. There is no magic length of transmission line that'll make your antenna work better. I'll bet you 20% of the guys on the 20-meter band today are looking for that magic length of transmission line to make their antenna work well. They're wasting their time. They can make measurements that seem to give them a confirmation of that philosophy. I am convinced that that philosophy is primarily wrong. Not everybody's going to agree with me on this one. This is a slightly controversial area. If there are any further questions or comments on this one, K2LAW, pass it over for comments first. Then I'm going to go over to Barry, N2MB. He's going to give us his comments. Barry, give me your comments right now. N2MB, K2LAW, go ahead.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Barry, you want to make a comment? Go right ahead. Okay, anyone else wants to make a comment?
Okay, here, Jeff.
Go ahead, Eric.
No, I'd give that gentleman a gum on the Bird website. The rectangular meters that I'm using is an example of the 4.5-inch EIA rigid line watt meter. 100 microamps to the rectangular meter, and the elements must be ordered according to the desired frequency and color ranges, meaning they calibrate it specifically. I just wanted to throw that in, and that's it. K2RWK,
Junior.
Comment? Yeah, I'm about to go to the 415, but go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Want to let things reset. KC2WGB. Dick, as anyone knows who has ordered a new Bird watt meter, you do get a transport slug. What is what Hal is talking about? It's just a common stainless steel barrel that goes in. It looks exactly like a slug, only there's no contacts, no elements in it at all. And you're supposed to, anytime you transport, have that slug in there, in the center hole. Once you put your testing slug in, that gets moved to one of the holes on the side of the instrument so that you always have it. When you finish testing, you put that back in, and you'll never have that problem. And that dampens the meter movement. That's what it's for. That's what Hal was talking about. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, sorry for the delay. I'm looking at my Bird watt meter right now. I've removed the slug. I'm looking at the contacts that are in there. I see them. And sure enough, Hal is right. When you've got that slug midway between the far clockwise and far counterclockwise, those contacts are touching the brass barrel, or the gold-plated barrel, I guess it's a brass barrel, on the side of the slug. Therefore, those two contacts are shorted out. And I'm about to confirm what Hal has been telling us, that I'm moving the meter. I see the meter moving freely. I set it midway. Oh, boy, is that meter damped. Wow. How have I lived all these years without knowing that? What rock have I been living under? I've been using Birds all these years.
Well, Dick, you know when you mail somebody a meter, you always short the contacts. So that's why it's done.
Okay. You were mailed a meter recently. Was that slug at the 12 o'clock position to damp that meter? I'm a little worried when you got that one. It might not have been set that way, John. Go ahead, John.
No, there was a slug in it. The position was not in operating either operational mode, but it was just off slightly. But I think it was off enough to dampen it, yes.
Okay, so we were lucky on that one. As you can tell, I mailed a John a meter recently. And so we were lucky. I was not smart enough to intentionally set it that way before it became mailed to you. So we were lucky on that one. And it's a beautiful, delicate meter, which I'd rather not damage it because it got shipped with high G's and wasn't being properly damped.
quick, also, just a quick comment. You should use the transport slug because due to vibration, that meter could, that slug could rotate sufficiently and make contact, and then, you know, you're back in the same position. So it's always best to use the transport slug.
Every new bird meter come with a solid aluminum slug that shorts the meter out to VJ tubing.
Yeah, we think that's the transport slug. Isn't that true, John?
Absolutely. It may not be aluminum. I have some that are stainless steel.
Now, let's go back to the so-called square law meter, the 415. Assuming it is the 415 that your questioner was asking us about, that is a beautiful machine. When you look at a Hewlett-Packard 415 crystal diode detecting square law meter, it's intended for standing wave ratio measurements on something like a slotted line. When you've got a slotted line, which has a crystal detector on its probe, that crystal detector by way of a BNC cable goes into the front end of this Hewlett-Packard 415 meter. That 415 meter has extremely high dynamic range. I think you can set it for numbers down to minus 70 up to plus 10 or something like that. It's got a whole lot of click, click, click ranges that I think move either 5 or 10 dB at a time. You've got a 415 sitting right in front of you, if I know you, John. Each click of the rotary dial on a Hewlett-Packard 415, how many decibels does it move? Over to you, John.
Dick, I would have to run into the lab to see that. I don't have it right in front of me. It's on the other side. But one note, now Hal may know this. Image that I have, the picture of the meter where I can't see the model number, it looks like a 400 VTVM with a 410. It's the old style. I don't think the 415, now I have E models, but I don't know if the 415 started out as that old type VTVM HP. I don't think it's the same instrument, but I'm not sure.
And the 415 is definitely intended for a square law crystal detector that's making standing wave ratio measurements. The 415 came in the A, B, C, D, E, a really beautiful instrument. Let's see what Eric's up to say before I go into my little discussion of that beautiful instrument. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
KE2RIW, K2EJ. I'm looking at the bird 43 manual. Under the heading of storage towards the end of the manual, when storing the meter, keep an element or dust plug, that silver thing they call a dust plug, in the element socket to prevent the intrusion of dust and to prevent damage to the meter movement. Now they say, take the highest power element, turn it so that the arrow points up midway between the forward and reflected position, detects the meter and will not expose the element diode to a dangerous potential should the line section be energized.
Why the highest power element?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why it's got to be the highest power element, but I know that you wanted to give us quite a few comments, Barry. I gave you a couple of calls earlier, so Ryder, why don't you give us your comments. You've used bird meters at all kinds of high powers with your moon-bounce transmitters, and I'd like to believe that you haven't fallen into that trap of measuring an extremely good kilowatt antenna using a 1-watt slug in the reverse mode to really see the reverse power. And two, moon-bounce. A guy who's done a lot of EME, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Well, I have a 2,500 watt slug. Shouldn't say that. But yes, I do, and I always used it. It works great. Never had any trouble. But my comment is just a quickie. I'm not going to stick around. I'll be listening, of course, but I just want to comment that 2 meters, 432, and 1296 are, in spite of the fact that you can't tell by looking on the internet tonight, and I did this happen to me yesterday. Yes, it's open. The beacons are very, very loud, and there are guys working each other. But according to the Heffer and Map and stuff like that, they ain't supposed to be doing it. I don't know, second night in a row I saw that.
From your experience, Barry, do those maps favor the HF bands and the VHF, UHF, SHF bands? I think behave a bit differently. So the maps that you're familiar with, particularly the one that's in the August issue of QST Magazine, pictured in the World Above 50 Megs, are those maps favoring a particular frequency region? Is that why they're not telling us now the opening that you're seeing? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Now, looking at that live on the internet right now, And I was told that it's supposed to be right around 2 meters. They're using some sort of beacons that are all over 2 meters all over the country. But I don't know, because it sure don't look like it, Dick. It really doesn't look like it.
Now, I'm going to guess, Barry, that you've been seeing a band opening for the last 24 hours or so. What I'm basing that on is that my digital television over-the-air broadcast reception on channels 2 was gone, channels 4 was flaky, let's see now, 8 and 9 were very flaky. A number of the channels were really acting like there was no signal there. Yet channel 25 was thoroughly disappearing. Channel 24 was disappearing. So in other words, what happens in the case of a band opening where you're getting co-channel interference, the digital demodulator will say, I give up, and it gives you nothing. So my guess is there's a correlation between all those failed channels. I can't believe that many broadcast centers in the Empire State Building went down. I think the co-channel interference getting into Huntington, where I live, is the reason why my converter says, hey, Dick, there ain't nothing there. Over to you, Barry, N2MB, K2RIW.
Hey, the band is wide open right now on TV land all the way down to, like, Virginia.
QED. Barry and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Barry.
That's what I was just confirming. And it's been that way since yesterday. It started yesterday about 6 o'clock at night, which is unusual, because usually you don't see this until 2, 3 in the morning. It doesn't start to do this. And it didn't go dead today, which it normally does after about 9 o'clock, it drops dead. It didn't do that today. So this is some kind of coastal thing. And I don't know why it's not showing up on those maps at all. Over to you, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric. I'll wait for the KE2EJ, KE2IW.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should mention that, because they actually called me. They lost my piece, Channel 13. That I pick up in Plainview and send back up to Syracuse. And at first I thought maybe, oh, gee, the antenna moved. I'm just trying to load it up a bit. No. I can't get Channel 2. I can't get 13. I was getting 11. I couldn't get 5. So then I just said, take a look at the equalizer and see, oh, there's some ascending signals here. So what I did was I rotated the antenna really off axis, dull out some of the co-channel stuff that I was getting. And I got 13 back, so they can at least watch it far away.
Channel 13 is WBEC from Baltimore right now.
Wow, that's a beautiful confirmation. Now, Eric, you're using one of the more modern equalizers. And I think you're telling me that even your modern equalizer, with this amount of co-channel interference from far away coming in by way of band openings, was not able to handle it. By way of your rotator on your Yagi-like antenna on the tower, you were able to null things out enough where you could bring reception back on some of those channels. I think that's what you just told us. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Dick, I have to take care of something. I'll be returning in about 3 minutes. KC2WGB.
Okay. Good luck with Cookie. Go ahead, Eric.
You know, my focus is only WNET, so that's all that folks are concerned about. I just went to maximum signal there and minimum junk from the other stations. So when I finally got really good signal on 13, I took a look around and see what else is there, and I think I got 9 and where it is. Still can't get CBS. I mean, even if I move it slightly, I can find one sweet spot, but again, my focus was strictly to get WNET, find the truth. I have an antenna there that's also on the road, but no, I'm not going to sit there all night and play.
Now, this is a beautiful opportunity, Eric, as long as we've got your ear right now. You keep your ear pretty close to the ground on the broadcast industry. Television over-the-air broadcast is what I'm discussing right now. And I suspect there are a number of proposals to make some kind of a change, to become a little bit more European as opposed to our ADS-B system and so on, which gives us, in theory, a little bit less vulnerability to co-channel interference. I think there is at least consideration and meetings being held as to whether or not our current system should be changed. Tell me a little bit about what you believe is the current status of those studies, I'm going to call them, and if the studies turn out to be a compendium of opinion, how soon can we expect any improvement of the situation? Right now, over the air broadcast does seem a hell of a lot more vulnerable than I wish it was. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, you're experiencing co-channel. In the old days, you had to watch TV through the bars. They'd see the 10 kilohertz spacing, the 25 kilohertz spacing, and you would see them as kind of like looking through glass bars, so to speak. Looking at them, well, they should come and go and fade, up and down. The digital world, you can start to, as it starts to come in, you start to get the little pixelation, and it's gone. There's nothing for you to see. Well, the new system that they're looking to move towards is it's another ODFM type of system, the OFDM. And it handles multitask considerably better. It requires much more power to get the same coverage area as ATSC. And it can be clobbered by co-channel just like anything else.
Oh-ho. So COFDM like system, the European mode, I think it's the European mode, you're telling me that maybe it has less vulnerability to impulse noise, but I think you're saying co-channel interference and inter-symbol distortion is going to give it a similar amount of grief, even with a very good equalizer for COFDM. And if that's true, then what would the advantage of us flipping over if we did? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, actually, we'll know the answer come January of next year, what's being decided. There's a couple of different systems out there that are being looked at, and some that were demonstrated. And don't forget that they're concerned with the ability to provide good pictures to moving vehicles. About that. Good pictures to moving vehicles, especially to the driver. So, it seems like COFDM or some form of ODFM is in order here. But the interesting part about the COFDM is, rather than a continuous carrier, the way we're looking at it, we're actually talking about thousands of little carriers that actually occupy this 6 megahertz worth of space. So, as you know, propagation is never a linear thing. Things can happen very quickly in terms of frequency. Is that we're talking about 6 megahertz here. So, the interesting aspect of this form of ODFM, if you've got some of the signal, you've got a good chance of demodulating it. You don't necessarily need all of the signal. You can think of it as like little bits of a hologram that have all the information at various different levels. So, you may have a little better resistance to co-channel, but I wouldn't bank on it. K2RIW, K3J.
Because the attempts are being made to put so many information streams, 3, 4, 5, 6 information streams on 1/6 megacycle channel, I'm guessing there aren't very many bits left over, so to speak, to do forward error correcting. As such, will ODFM, COFDM be significantly different from 8VSB when it comes to surviving errors because of propagation, surviving errors because of co-channel? I'm guessing there's not very many bits left over to do forward error correcting, the Turby encoding demodulation techniques. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Very poor guesses. actually, stuff wouldn't work without the Turby, without the TELUS, without the convolution encoding. Actually, the FEC, you can actually get a choice in the COFDM. It's in 8VSB, I think it's 5.8, and in some COFDM, it's 2/3. So, for every packet, there's in essence 2 FEC packets. I mean, it's pretty packed. You can actually, if you want to increase it, reduce your bit rate, but nobody wants to do that because you only got so much space.
again, the magnitude of co-channel interference that I've been getting in the last 12 or 24 hours on some of those channels was so severe that my signal strength bar chart, in some cases, measured absolute zero. In other words, my particular demodulator thought there was no carrier, there was no information, there was nothing there. The co-channel interference was that severe. I bet we don't get it quite that bad very often. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, this is the height of December. You know what happens, especially at the lower frequencies. It also happens upstairs. You know, different parts of the band get affected at different times. Good thing about analog is that you can still live through it. You know, I don't care whether it's the OFDM. Actually, your Wi-Fi stuff is the OFDM. When it comes to interfering signals, don't stand too much of a chance. You get a threshold, and then you're done. At least with the analog stuff, you may not really see the picture, but you'll still hear the sound.
When it comes to so-called band openings, some of it is called sporadic heat propagation. Some of it is super refraction. I'll give you a couple of words on each of these. In the case of sporadic E, there's a kind of a cloud that exists at relatively high levels. I think we're talking about something like 60 kilometers up. A very high, intense cloud that moves almost always to the northwest at something like 150 miles an hour. Where the cloud comes from, some people think it originates in Africa and it spreads up toward us, but this intensely reflecting cloud on frequencies as high as the 2-meter handband will give you some very long-range reflection. That could be it, but I doubt it. I think we're getting more likely super refraction. You're about to ask, what the hell is super refraction? Let me drop. And I'm one who has made a lot of use of super refraction, particularly on 10 gigs and also on 432. Quite often a weather condition exists where a moist layer of air is down close to the surface of the earth and very dry air is up high. And when you get that, because the high moisture content, because water has a dielectric constant of 81, so that the water vapor molecules is not the right word, aerosols, the aerosols of water vapor in the air increase the air's dielectric constant. So high moisture content in air down low and dry air up top causes a downward bending of the propagated radio wave. If that downward bending happens to have the right refractive index so that when the wave follows Earth's curvature, then that signal that's coming from 500 or 1,000 miles away, you'll think that signal is so strong when it gets to you that it's in your backyard. Your radio horizon, in my case, with a good-sized tower on 300-foot high land, I've got a radio horizon out there of 40 miles. But with this super refraction phenomena, there are times when I can hear a 480-mile signal away on the 432 ham radio band or a 380-mile 10 gigahertz band. The guy sounds like he's in my backyard. 40 dB over S9 signals, if you know what I mean. Super refraction, when it happens, oh boy, can it give you some very long-range signals. The broadcast people, I guess, have a bit of trouble planning for this. They said, let me drop. The FCC licensing is such that you distribute your broadcast stations around the nation such that hopefully there's non-overlapping areas. The Channel 2...
Langley Rice is for.
Yep. So Langley Rice is a mathematical formula that tries to predict the probability of this jazz happening. And so I'd like to believe that the FCC will schedule a RF channel 33 in New York City and an RF channel 33, I don't know where, but maybe Washington, D.C. But they're far enough apart that most of the time those service areas do not overlap. But when you start getting this kind of refraction, boy, can they overlap. You probably got some more words on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, the FCC actually came out with a new mathematical formula, which actually they had to rewrite three times because it didn't even correctly show what the coverage of the AT station does. And the distance separating stations rules have changed over the years. I think it's 120 miles now for VHF. I'm but I don't really remember. But again, I can look that up if you're really interested. But there is a definite minimum distance, and then the controllers have to have a certain spacing between them to be for a co-channel. But as they go into this repacking for this auction that's coming up, what's basically going to happen is it's going to turn into a huge mess. Don't forget, with digital television, you don't need a guard channel. Whereas in any metropolitan area in the analog days, you could have a 2, you couldn't have a 3, but you could have a 4. Between 4 and 5, there's actually a whole lot of guard space. The public, there's a small public service band in between. There's 72, there's 90 megahertz, I forget. But somewhere in there, so that way you could have a 4 and a 5, but you can't have a 6, then you can have a 7, you can't have an 8, you can have a 9, blah, 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 so on and so forth. With the digital stuff, you can have a signal on every channel, and they don't bother each other.
Now, I was at a meeting this afternoon in which I sat with Bob Myers, K2 Tango Victor, who has worked for quite a few years with... I should know. I'm guessing it was NBC. I don't think it was CBS. Anyhow, in the world of broadcast. And we were discussing the subject of the current status of over-the-air digital television broadcast and will it survive. You're now telling us that there is a series of meetings taking place with reference to how far apart the channels should be set. And even if the FCC will allocate broadcast centers, let me pick a number, 160 miles apart, when these super refraction propagation modes come along. Let me drop.
None of their mathematical stuff takes that into consideration, you know that.
Well, the point I was getting at is no matter what they set off for reasonable spacing between broadcast centers on the exact same channel, RF channel, no matter what number they choose, it's only going to work a certain percentage of the time. When you get one of these super refraction or sporadic E opening situations, a signal from 1,000 miles away can come into your area really potent. As such, you can't ask the FCC to set 1,000-mile spacings between broadcast centers. 160 miles, maybe it's a reasonable number, and maybe it's going to work 98% of the time. So that no matter what spacing they use, you're going to get co-channel interference some number of times in the summertime, and I think there's no good way of avoiding it other than recognizing the fact that usually the very far away channel most of the time comes from some other angle. So if you've got enough spatial directivity of your antenna, and if your television aerial, which in the old days didn't need a rotator, and if you're smart enough to use a rotator for your over-the-air broadcast reception these days, as Eric was indicating to us,
I've got a good solution.
A good percent of the time you can restore performance. So what is your great solution, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW, wait for the beep.
It's all about the same thing that you and I have been talking about. It's all about timing. Okay, in the old days, we used to offset co-channel transmitters from one another to identify who was doing the co-channeling. What we could do here is we can say, all right, we lock everything up by GPS. This station over here is going to be on this time slot, and this station over there is going to be on that time slot. And since the information that we're interested in only exists between the pseudorandom noise that's being generated, we could layer them so that they look like a comb. They would fit together like the teeth of a comb, and then the receiver would simply say, okay, it's these teeth that I want, not those teeth. And it would work.
We have you watching TV.
I think you got the beginning here, Eric, of a good working proposal, but let me show you a problem. The rate of propagation, speed of light, roughly 6 microseconds per nautical mile, 5 and a fraction microseconds per statute mile. Therefore, if the two channels that are giving me the co-channel interference are 1,000 miles apart, the timing difference between the two, just because of propagation...
That's why you teach it.
It's going to be milliseconds. I would like the dead times of station A to have... in other words, the intersymbol distortion. I would like to take those individual combs from station A and combers from B, station B, and stack them in such a way that I can suggest, I can time it, I can, or if I can't shift the timing of the broadcast station from, let's say, 1,000 miles away, in order to favor me in this location, and then a friend of mine that's 10 miles further to the west needs another timing correction. How can we accomplish that one, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Can I play about that? And actually, we may be talking milliseconds. Tens of milliseconds for us, that's a bit much, but there's a number of things that we can do. We've offset carriers, change the positions of where the symbol will actually occur. That would be far enough away that, say, a signal traveling from California is going to get there, say, let's see if we can figure it out, pull out your calculator, but let's just for the sake of it say it's going to be 10 milliseconds off. So I could offset the carrier frequency a little bit and move where my symbols are going to actually be and be in the noise space within a window. So if we're calculating that something is going to be that far away, or something is, you're going to know where the geographic locations of where your code channels are, and you could work that out so as that everybody actually exists in their own space and still fits within the edge of the band.
I see a possibility here of making this work, Eric, if and only if there was only direct line of propagation. You and I know that any broadcast center from the Empire State Building, for instance, is going to be sending a signal out to Huntington, where I live, and there is a direct signal, there's a signal reflecting off that water tower, there's a signal reflecting off everything in the environment. I'm getting all kinds of simultaneous signals when no co-channel is present. Now you add co-channel, where there's all kinds of ground bounce and atmospheric bounce going on. Timing between these things is going to get pretty spooky. Can you really shift the timing in such a way that it becomes invulnerable? I'm a little worried that we may be asking for a solution that's got too many restrictions. It may be mutually exclusive. I hope I'm not just being too pessimistic. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, we started talking simply. I mean, we can get more complex about this. Where the sync word shows up, so on and so forth. We're going to set up the timing for the receiver. There's definitely a lot of issues that would have to be dealt with here. Just even an inflection off a water tower, how much is that going to confuse your receiver? What's the main signal? Is it coming from the transmitter, or is it the receiver saying the main signal is the one coming from the water tower, which makes the signal from the water tower, as far as the receiver is concerned, earlier? Don't forget, what we're doing is we're going to be digitizing these little bits that come about. Of course, we're making this transition from RF to digits. And there's a lot of ways that we can determine where timing is. But you can have a signal with noise and all sorts of junk in it. If you're doing it synchronously instead of asynchronously, you don't even have to predict where the pulses are supposed to be. You know exactly where they're supposed to be. So there are different kinds of circuitry. Like we did in an analog world, we came up with new ways of stripping sync based upon what's around it. We can do something similar to that in terms of generating the timing for the entire chain that's going to be used and knowing where it belongs. But let's say we've got multiple reflections, meaning that we're going to wind up with symbols that are jittering in place, and it's going to show up as we try to turn that into IMQ. So, I'm sure somebody with a real lot of smarts can come up with a way to differentiate between those. Do a dynamic type of tracking and noise reduction to follow where the pulses are and instruct the rest of the chain to ignore the stuff on...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's all math. What can I tell you? It's something that... we may see down the road. And by the way, COFDM does offer some advantages as opposed to the system of being able to do something like that. K2IW, K2J.
Yeah, I think we've got a situation here, Eric, where on paper, there may be a good-looking, good-sounding solution. But until it's tested in the real world, at various ranges, in various multipath environments, with and without water towers, with and without co-channel interference, we'll never really be sure. Mother Nature can be always a little bit more complicated, a little bit more nasty in propagation than you anticipate. And every radio signal transmitted by any antenna we have ever used is putting some level of signal into every single object in your environment around that antenna. There's reflection coming from everything. You can't stop it from happening. You think you've got direct line of sight. You stand on top of your tower and you look at the Empire State Building, and with your binoculars you've got a beautiful line of sight. I do. And therefore you think that's the only signal getting to me. Absolutely not. There's thousands of other signals from other locations and other time delays and other phase shifts coming to me simultaneously in this so-called ideal situation on top of my hill, on top of my tower, with my antenna, you know what I mean? Which is not there yet, but it soon will be. What I'm getting at is, let me drop this. I hope before we commit the whole darn United States to flipping over from System A to System B on the improvement and the ultra-high fidelity and whatever, I'd like to believe there'll be some real field testing. I know that when the 8VSB was fully tested in the field, I think they rapidly discovered how vulnerable it was to lower VHF impulse noises, and therefore essentially none of the current digital TV channels are using lower VHF. The frequencies below channel 5 in the old days of numbering. So, to your knowledge, Eric, are they planning some real field tests of any significant amount of time before committing to a new system? And I think you're saying there might be a commitment this coming January. Is that what I heard you say earlier? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
K2LIW, K2EJ, from what I understand, is your meeting either in December or January where they're deciding on parts of the system. The audio part is up because there's the Dolby method, there's another method. Oh, I forget. It's MPEG-H. Actually, the MPEG-H audio allows you to control, the viewers control the volume of the announcer or the background noise, or it gives you actually knobs because the individual bits of information are being kind of mixed together in the TV. Actually, at NAB in April, one system was demonstrated for a week over the air. There's a station in Cincinnati, is it, that just got the SDL to run another system for a couple of months to see how that goes. So there is real-time testing besides what's going on in the laboratory. It's a progressive thing in that respect. The ultimate goal, really, especially with the new system, is really in essence to make television cellular, so to speak, where you put in a community, X number of low-power transmitters that are all on the same frequency, they're all synchronized with each other, and you design it in such a way so where they overlap, the propagation delays from the adjacent transmitter meet each other, and you don't get dead zones. So, fuck with that. I'm trying to do that actually right now with an FM station. And the main transmitter's in West Orange, and on top of Fort Times Square, I'm going to have 12 watts that have to somehow or other really get synchronous to the point that I don't wind up with all the picket fencing junk where the stuff beats them to each other. Because the timing isn't exactly.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I was listening on the input, we only lost a couple of words, Eric. You did talk about some of the over-the-air testing with authorization from the FCC, which I thought is sometimes called an STL. That's FTA, Special Temporary Authority. You called it STL. I'm not quite familiar with that, those particular letters there.
No, my acronyms got all jumbled. STL stands for Studio to Transmit One. STA is a Special Temporary Authority. That's what I meant. Sorry.
You're forgiven this time. Just don't do it again. I'm having some fun with him. Well done, Eric. Okay, so you believe some STAs have been issued, some over-the-air broadcast testing of these new proposed systems is taking place right now. I hope there's enough testing in enough locations, enough ranges, where many of the, what I'm looking for now, artifacts, many of the glitches are going to be discovered, and you have reason to believe that the new more OFDM or COFDM system, a little bit less 8 VSB, you have reason to believe it's going to make an improvement, and I hope so, because we were sort of promised that the new digital television system would have essentially the same range as the old analog system. And in the analog days, there were a lot of people in my town watching over-the-air broadcast television. I've got a town that I live in with 26,000 people, and one single human being, to my knowledge, in this town, has over-the-air television broadcast reception capability. And so, yes, some of that is because people in an affluent area, let me drop this. They want special sports and special pay-per-view type programming, and so therefore they signed up with cable and satellite, and I can sort of understand that. Still, though, there are certain communities scattered around the tri-state area where those particular people really are dependent on over-the-air television broadcast, and they don't think they can afford those other more premium things. So I guess my question is, do you believe enough testing is in the process of taking place that we're going to discover the glitches, and are some of the disadvantages of the current system about to improve? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KHVJ. Well, you know, most of the rest of the world are on a form of OFDM. There's a lot of experience out there. But you do have to consider one thing, especially when it comes to Europe, where there's a tri-saturation. A typical grade B area for the United States might be leading somewhere into another country by the geographic size. So there's a big difference there. There's also a big difference in the amount of electricity. There's a considerable difference between the VSB and the COFDM, but then again, they're thinking about the COFDM in terms of distributed distribution, meaning smaller transmitters strategically placed, a cellular-like pattern to cover a given area. That's one aspect of it. But as we get away from the metropolitan areas where over-the-air TV is really important when you're dealing with economic income, close into transmitters, people have no problem using Rapidus, and you'd be surprised how many people are on Rapidus when they drop to it. As you get further away, now here's the issue. The whole concept of the 8VSB is that when you're in nice terrain, that you can get the typical grade B of an analog, which you can. In your case, you can't, simply because of elevation issues. But, you know, you can see the Empire State Building. If you go to the FCC website and look at the ERPs of the various different stations, you'll understand why some stations are a little nicer than others. But it's still finicky. You know that they were testing antennas on top of the World Trade Center. Well, the way they made the measurement, which is huge, barge of adjuvant and Rosen Schwartz automated measuring stuff. And for each point where they essentially stopped, put up the antenna, pushed the button, they took thousands of different kinds of measurements. So, you know, once they categorized that and collated it all together, I'll see what the actual results are. A lot better than, at this point, it seems to be a lot better than what the Empire is doing. So, RIWK2J.
Eric, you just brought up another very interesting point. And that is the top of the new World Trade Center, Freedom Tower, whatever it's called, 1,790 feet or something like that. And
1776, the year the country was born.
Yes, that's the altitude of the building, the master's house.
The top of the spire is 1776.
There are websites claiming a bigger number, and maybe they're in error. Okay, I'll go for the 1776. At the rate we're going, Eric, in the next 5 or 10 years, what percentage of the current broadcast centers at Empire are truly going to move over to to the new Freedom Tower? Is it going to be 10%, 50%, 90%? I'm having trouble believing that after the big investment was made to reestablish themselves an empire, I think a certain percentage of those broadcast entities are going to be a little bit reluctant to start all over again and reestablish some pretty expensive equipment on the new structure.
Ah, but that's where the whole concept of business comes into play.
And give us a few words on that, Doc, and make sure you drop every minute and a half. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, the people who manage the building is a desk organization who operates as Four Times Square, where there's a lot of stuff. They are offering incentives that literally almost says that you move here, we'll pay the cost.
Yeah, I think they have no choice. If they didn't do that, they're going to have a half-empty building. I know that the Empire State Building was not a profit-making center for a good number of years or decades from the time it was built.
1950, Dick.
There you go. So it was built in, what, 1938 or so, 35, somewhere around there. And 1950 is when it started turning a profit.
When is one of those?
How about when the old World Trade Center was built? How many years did it take before it made a profit?
Really never did, Dick, because Port Authority occupied most of it.
Okay, so to a certain degree, it didn't have to make a profit. I'm guessing people are projecting that the new Freedom Tower is going to take a good number of years before it has enough occupancy where it becomes a profit-making organization.
They have to finish building it first.
It's not yet finished? I thought it was. I thought they're already bringing the guests in and showing a beautiful view.
I don't remember which floor it is, but something from the whole two-thirds of the top of the building, the top of the top of the building, isn't, the interior isn't done yet.
And most of them want sheetrock, Dick.
Okay, even if the bottom half of the building is all that's finished, if someone told me that they've got 25% occupancy of the bottom half of the building, I'd be a little bit surprised by that. Am I that far wrong, Eric? Go ahead.
No, let me recycle. Hang on. Before they even started construction on the building, they got commitments from several very large organizations occupied, you know, to pre-lease. A lot of it's pre-leased. There's people waiting to get in. So occupancy, I don't think it's going to be an issue for them. Although, I haven't really looked into this, and I think I haven't even thought about it. Like, things could change.
Okay, with what you know with the incentives that the Freedom Tower is offering broadcast entities, do you believe a high percentage of them will take the incentive and will move their primary broadcast to the new Freedom Tower, and they will consider holding on to Empire as a standby or thoroughly give up Empire? What's your guess as to what the next 5 or 10 years of use of those two infrastructures are going to be like, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
K2RW, K2EJ. Well, it's going to depend on a couple of factors that it really flopping in the wind. One is the result of the RF survey, which I'm sure everybody's been liking. The other is the incentive auctions that are just about coming around the corner. Everybody's kind of waiting for that to happen. By the way, if you do look at the elected channels that most of the broadcasters around the country have chosen, because they have to vacate the space of the UHF spectrum, and throughout the country, there's an awful lot of VHF spectrum. All things being said, and if this auction actually goes off the way that they're planning, the low VHF and the high VHF, there's going to be a station on every number.
Wow. Are you telling me that old Channel 2, 54 to 60, is going to be fully occupied, for instance? And are they going to be occupied with other services than digital over-the-air television? Over to you, Eric.
It's going to be digital over-the-air television, but what does digital over-the-air television mean? Okay, it means TV, but it could also mean OEM for your city, which I actually did on channel 13 for a couple of years until they finally moved up, you know, until the system was finalized. They moved to, I think it was 5K system, either 5K system. So, you know, what is it you call digital television? It's really a transmission of a stream of data, whatever you put on it, but it will be licensed as a TV station. Its primary purpose will be a TV station. The rest of the stuff will be on tour, just like bits and burrs work.
I see a problem here, Eric. Channels 2 through 5 are FYs, 54 to 70 some odd megacycles, are very vulnerable to impulse noise when it comes to digital pictures being transmitted. What is new about the new assignments and the new auction that's about to be held that'll suddenly make the vulnerability of modern digital techniques, what's going to subtract that impulse noise vulnerability? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Now, there's a couple of things that are going on. First of all, there are quite a few channel 2s that are on digital. Actually, a low-power channel 3 that's on Citibank building. Parker Kent, I think he's even got a channel 2 or channel 3 down there in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The thing that really drives them is that there will be a change in the rules, which will allow you to run a whole bunch more power than you could before on UHF, and the way we are on VHF. I mean, channel 13 right now is running an ERP of something like 43 kilowatts. The transmitter is TPO before it even gets into the combiner and all that stuff. But what kilowatts, so get some gain going on. You don't have the big power signals like you had in terms of the analog days, but the auction, one of the incentives is, yeah, we'll let you run lower power.
You just said channel 13 ERP, 43 kilowatts, but I guess some of that is antenna gain. There's really 4 kilowatts of RF going into a roughly 10 dB gain antenna. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, well, you got to count the loss in the pipe, and you have to count the loss in the combiner. And then you have to count the loss in the power divider. Yeah, and then take the phase of that one. Gain of those things is something like, look it up, maybe like 6.17 or some stupid number like that in terms of gain.
Okay, good information. And the 43 kilowatts of ERP now, back in the analog days, roughly what was that ERP, Eric?
I licensed ERP was something like 285 kilowatts. Well, it used to be a 24 kilowatt transmitter. Gain of antenna. Yeah, I think it was something like 286. I can look it up. It's up in that neighborhood.
That's close enough. So analog days, we had something like 285, 286 kilowatts of ERP. Today, our ERP is 4.43 kilowatts. That's a significant come down. And it's a system that's a little bit more vulnerable to multipath and impulse noise. I think we're seeing the mathematics of how we lost some range. Am I being a little bit too severe in my analysis? Over to you, Eric.
Well, logic kind of dictates less power, less range, but talking about different types of modulators, energy being centered in one place as opposed to being spread out evenly across the whole thing. Incidentally, I run 4 counseling at 4,800 watts, and my ERP is about 93 kilowatts. In the analog days, I would run 60 kilowatts, and over half a megawatt of ERP.
Nice numbers. Wow. And when you talk about the old days of 285 kilowatts on channel 13, I presume that is peak envelope power of sync pulse. And nowadays, we're talking more about something closer to RMS power, or in the case of 8BSB, is there an equivalent peak envelope power? Over to you, Eric.
They call it peak average power. Don't ask me how they get there, but it's really a little complicated.
Peak average power. That sounds like an interesting mixture of words. I'm the biggest midget there was. I'm the smallest tall man there ever was. Wow. Peak average power. Great sounding term. I guess you're saying the definition of that could be a little bit spooky. Hey, it's fun, Eric, because these